Hello, everyone. This is Nicholas Kapman with the FDA Group. Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as CMC. We offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you ever find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com to check us out and get in touch. So today I am speaking with Jessica Beaver. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Nick. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Yourself?
I'm well, thank you. Glad it's Friday.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for joining me. So today we're going to be talking about people that are in the quality and regulatory space that are in the first or second quadrant of their career and some of the questions people generally ask about their career path. And you and I are going to dive into that and go over some of the questions that are kind of typically asked for those types of individuals and see if we can find some useful information and nuggets that people can use as they're trying to figure out the answers to these questions. So before we do that, could you introduce yourself and your background?
Absolutely. So I'm Jessica. I have been working in the pharmaceutical industry for over 20 years. I started my career first as a pharmacist while I was in graduate school, but quickly moved into the pharmaceutical industry as a contributing scientist with a large pharma company. Navigated my way through the first half of my career, really focused in the sciences as a contributing scientist and team member on product development teams, and then moved into the regulatory affairs and then quality space about halfway through my career. And then have spent the rest of my time doing that in different ways with different types of companies, both pharma and medical device. So that's a little bit about me, Nick.
Very good. Thank you. So before we started recording, you and I were talking, and one of the things that you said, which I think rings true, certainly for me and the vast majority of the audience, is nobody ever dreamed of getting into quality and regulatory. Right?
Correct. Yeah. Not the aspiration of a child.
No, certainly not. But there's obviously a huge industry for that. And, you know, I like to say, you know, a couple things. One is I tripped and fell into it. Again, nobody really thought that's what they wanted to do. And then, you know, another kind of more general thing with the pharmaceutical industry is you need pharmaceutical experience to get in. But you can't get the experience unless you're in. So how do you get in without experience? And there's that whole thing. But some of the questions that you and I were going through as we were kind of talking about this podcast is a lot of people out there are asking themselves questions like, should I become a specialist or should I be a generalist? You know, or before I even get into that, how do I increase my value? I'm in quality and regulatory. I've been here for several years. I feel like this is a niche where I want to stay. Now what? Should I become a specialist? Should I become a generalist? Should I stay at one company or should I get into consulting? Should I work for a large company or a startup company? Small molecule, large molecule, pharma and biotech, med device, should I stay as a worker or a manager? There's a lot of different questions that people throughout their career have to ask themselves. And I think that's what we're going to try to figure out today. So did you want to start with the specialization and generalist question, or was there a different place you wanted to start?
I think that sounds like a great place to start, Nick, because I think a lot of folks struggle with that particular question. As you start off at the earlier stages of your career in regulatory, you're usually starting with a particular therapeutic area, a particular molecule type, et cetera. And so you're getting and gaining experience in that area. So at that earlier first part of your career, you really are focused on a particular area. And so the question becomes, as you and I were talking about, do you stay with that? Or do you try and broaden your horizons, if you will, across different therapeutic areas and such? So, you know, I would say that it really kind of depends on where you want to go. There's a balance, just like there isn't anything else, in order to tackle that. There are some advantages to staying a specialist because you become very knowledgeable, sought after in those areas. But there are also some downsides to that. We were talking earlier about the fact that, the current environment that we live in and work in and our work environments is not necessarily 100% stable. And you may find yourself in a position where you have to pivot pretty quickly. So being able to have some experiences in other areas may be valuable. It may be valuable to be a specialist, but it just sort of depends on the situation. So I think it's important to think through that a little bit for yourself and what your own aspirations are as a regulatory professional as you grow your career into the second, third, fourth quadrant of time.
Yeah. And what are some of the questions that people should be asking themselves as they try to determine specialization versus generalist or maybe even a hybrid? What are some of the, and we talked there's benefits and there's risks to both. What are some of the benefits and risks in your opinion?
So I would say that what you need to ask yourself is somewhat what you feel passionate about doing. From my personal experiences, I like the chance to delve into all kinds of different problems. So you might consider me more of a generalist, even though I have specific areas that I probably specialize in. I like to be able to kind of delve into all different types of things because I'm a problem solver and I like to, as I say, I like to do puzzles. So that's part of what drives me to feel that way. So I think those are questions you can ask yourself as far as like, what do I really like to do? Do I like to dive deep into something? Or do I like that idea of being able to be a problem solver in a broad way? So that's a good question to ask yourself.
Yeah, kind of the focus laser versus the Swiss Army knife, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So when it comes to specialization, what are some of the benefits and what are some of the risks? Obviously, you said, passion, right? But the passion there is more, do I like to focus on one thing versus kind of have a broader skill set? So let's say I'm leaning towards specialization. What are some of the things I can look forward to, and what are some of the risks that I have to be aware of and accept?
So I think some of the benefits are you become quite knowledgeable in your area, and then you become valuable and sought after for that experience. So I think that's an important value and benefit to being a specialist in a particular area. As I said earlier, I think the risks are that you're going to have to pivot at some point, and that becomes more difficult to do. I think we've all found ourselves in situations where in a job seeking situation where we end up having, we hear from someone that we don't have exactly the right experience that they're looking for. To that, I just say keep going, of course. You'll find your fit at some point. But I think it is a risk you run if you are very specialized in one particular area. But
Yeah.
if you find the if you find the right spot, you'll be a very valuable asset.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is if you have a passion for a specific area, then you would encourage them to certainly consider becoming a specialist in that space. But if they needed to pivot, what is the likelihood that that specialization has other options? We're talking about radiopharmaceuticals, which is very nichey, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And if so, and that's really something that you want to do, but you see that this space could grow, then maybe it makes sense. Whereas maybe there's another area of specialization, and I can't think of an example right off the top of my head, where you have a passion for it, but you see it dying down, right? And that this obviously doesn't have to do with our industry, but somebody that was a specialist in buggy whips, right? You might start seeing that in the 1920s and 30s, not kind of going away, right? So you might want to reconsider whether or not that's an area of focus. Not to dissuade the audience, but are there any examples of specialization that now I use the example of radiopharmaceuticals. I'm not saying that's going to go away, but it certainly is a smaller area. Are there any specializations that on its face seem kind of risky to you, either because they're very small or because you think that maybe over time there might be less of a demand for that?
Honestly, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, Nick, I think what you're highlighting, though, is a need to stay aware of what's happening in our industry. So it's important to not only, keep your head down and doing the work that you're trying to do, but also kind of looking up and understanding. To your point, what are the developments in therapeutics that are happening? Again, we're not necessarily developing, we still are, but we're not quite as, laser focused on small molecules that, oral dosage forms, et cetera. I think that ebbs and flows a little bit over the time I've been in the industry. But there are things that are more attractive to investors at this particular point with regard to what's going to be funded. There are things that are more attractive from a scientific point of view. So really keeping your head up too, and really understanding what's going on in the industry so that if you do choose to specialize, that you're specializing in something that has some longevity associated with it and isn't necessarily the hottest thing right now and may, die off in the future.
Yeah. Are there any places that you think people could go to that would allow them to relatively easily and efficiently keep a pulse on those types of things?
I mean, I think, formats like these are good ones to stay in touch with. I think your group does a good job of trying to keep, especially for regulatory professionals, a lay of the land, if you will. And there are a number of different groups. There are blogs that you can subscribe to. There are newsletters and such. It can be a little overwhelming at times, so it's probably good to do a little bit of homework about sort of what do you feel like you need to know to stay present and current with what's happening in the industry. So don't do it too much. I mean, we are in an information-rich environment these days, and so it can become somewhat overwhelming. Find something, ask someone that is a supervisor, a mentor, what do they sort of do to keep up to date with what's going on in the industry? But I think those are all good ways to do that. And then pick what works for you. And then, to be honest, setting aside a little time to dedicate to that. Like, that's, if you're going to be a part of this industry, it's important to understand what's happening within the industry. So take time each day to read the paper, if you will, if that's the proverbial, if we'd still looked at newspapers. But you know what I'm saying is, like, just have a little bit your niche, whether it's at lunch or before you start your day or at the end of the day, just that you can kind of keep your hand and your finger on the pulse of what's happening.
And to your earlier point about the FDA group, we have blogs, webinars, white papers,
Absolutely.
podcasts. We have the Insider newsletter. So for anybody that is looking for information, certainly go to the FDAgroup.com under resources. That's where you can find all that stuff, and you might find more and more of those useful to you. So let's move over to the generalist side. What are some of the benefits and risks associated with if that's the path that I'm taking?
So I think the benefits on the generalist side is you're flexible, you're adaptable, you are able to tackle all kinds of problems. And so in certain environments, that becomes very advantageous and you become valuable in that regard. That could be in more of the consulting type of role because you have experiences that you can leverage in different situations. It also can be advantageous because, you're able to tackle any problem. And that can be viewed by some organizations, especially small ones that need to be nimble, flexible, quick, and may, change their tactics or strategy fairly quickly, that you can adapt and change with them. Obviously, the downside of that is, again, some people are looking for specialists. And if you have too broad of a background, again, have found myself in the same types of situations as others that are job seekers that say, well, you don't have, we want someone who really specializes in this area, that they really do have, they already have the contacts, for example, at the FDA, where they can, call and strategize with a project manager or something. That's, you know, that's helpful to some degree, but at the same time, again, there are benefits and risks to both.
Yeah. So that's great. So I think I want to move into the next one for me. And I was trying to think about this and trying to make it as chronological as it seems to be. But let's talk about large companies versus startup companies, right? You know, there's benefits and risks to both. So let's start with the large company. What do you think people should consider when saying, is that going to be kind of my place in the world?
So I like the large company for, it's a very educational, valuable prospect, right? Because you have the opportunity to learn a lot about our industry and understand how everything works. Because there are lots of individuals that you come into contact with. You get to see basically specialists in all their different areas, whether that's in CMC or clinical or non-clinical. You get a lot of exposure to a lot of different people. There's always a lot of educational opportunities in larger companies that I encourage everyone to take advantage of as much as they can, because I think those are valuable resources for those that are advancing their careers. But I think that's one of the things that, like, I look back, I spent the first part of my career at a large pharma, and but I've never been back to a large pharma. So we can get to the small company in a minute, and why maybe that's the case for me. But, you know, one of the things I really appreciated about my time in large pharma was being able to learn how the industry really worked. You know, not perfect, but you really do get exposure to all of these different areas. And as you move into that regulatory affairs space, you need to be knowledgeable, right, of how this is going to, you know, you got to advise your CMC colleagues, your non-clinical colleagues, your clinical colleagues on how to, you know, best present their information and all of those things. So I think the large pharma opportunity does create that, that environment where you can learn quite a bit about what we do.
It also seems like it's a place that's a little bit more in line with people that desire career growth. So if, and I know this was kind of more of a typical conversation early in my career, which was the corporate ladder and how do you climb it? So I think that's one of the benefits to the large company. Some of the risks or challenges associated is bureaucracy and personalities. Yes. I also would argue that there isn't this misconception that large companies are more stable, because they are stable until Amazon lays off 19,000 people, right? So, and there are these waves that can happen. So,
yes.
I think perhaps you and I would be open to a debate that yes, that happens, but it still is more stable than startups. I would certainly welcome that. However, just because it's a large company doesn't mean you've got a job forever.
Certainly true in today's work environment. That's very true. And I think that's been true probably for most of our careers, Nick. Mm. I mean, it was probably considered more stable earlier, but I think it has been a little bit more
volatile.
Yeah, a little volatile.
Yeah.
Over the last 10 years.
What about startups? What are some of the benefits and risks with that?
So, startups, I mean, I'm a lover of startups at this point in my career, so I'm a strong advocate for that time. Like, I love my time in big pharma, but I really have loved my time in smaller environments. And I've worked in small companies that are, you know, not so small that they're tiny, but I've also worked for some tiny companies. And I think the advantages there, this is what I've always said to folks when they are considering small companies. When you're at a large company, there are folks right on either side of you that are working you know, you're like all running down the same path towards success. When you look to your right and you look to your left in the smaller company, the distance between yourself and the next person over is much wider. And so what that means is there's a good opportunity to do more. And so for the regulatory professional, I think you have the opportunity to really dive in and help the company as a whole, not just a team, right? The company as a whole be successful, because ultimately the success of the company is really rooted in whether or not there's regulatory success. I mean, it comes from clinical success, and it comes from being able to get a molecule or a potential candidate through the gauntlet, if you will. But regulatory has a big role in that, because it's the stories we tell and how we put all that information together. And so you have a big opportunity to influence things, I think, in a small company in a way that you don't always have in a larger company. And I
One of
think,
the,
go ahead.
no, you go, and then I'll give my thought.
Yeah, I was just thinking. And then on the, the flip side of the coin is the risk, of course. I mean, and there's the risk that we all understand about being in a small startup organization, is that it could all collapse at any time, just because things don't work out. And there's not that safety net of a larger company with a broad portfolio in order to, support the riskier projects. By definition, startup projects are usually pretty risky. So there's that side of it. But again, I think that's valuable experience. And hopefully, if you find yourself in that situation, you can pivot and leverage what you've learned to move on to the next.
Interestingly enough, I've always found startups a little bit more interesting for me. And we can use the term startup and small company kind of synonymously, even though they're not exactly the same thing. There are a couple things that I liked about or a few things I like about startups. One is you can wear a lot of hats. So when it goes back to kind of that generalist thing, you might actually be able to touch more areas and therefore broaden your experience. I really like that. I think if you can get into a startup that succeeds, there's some financial gains, especially if you can negotiate equity within the organization or phantom stock or options or anything like that.
Absolutely.
I think that's really interesting. But the one that I probably like the most is being part of a story. And I don't know how valuable that is to other people outside of me, but I've had a couple instances where I started small and became much larger. And it's really exciting to be on that journey. And the journey itself is very exciting. I think while at times it can bring in a level of stress that is unacceptable, I think it also, on the flip side, can bring in a level of stress that is useful. I like to believe that we always need to be on a scale of 1 to 10, about a 2 or a 3 in terms of our stress. I think that's healthy. I think, you know, 3 to 5 is probably manageable. If you're getting above 5, it might be a little too much. But if you're below 2, then I don't think you're growing. So I think there has to be a little bit of that. So the journey is a big part of it. The option of financial payout is a big part of it. And then if and when you actually leave, it's again, because I said it's a story, it's a good story. You can talk about it. And just that journey of going from something that's an idea or, you know, subsequently after that to something that has become an established brand, you learn a lot. There's a lot to take away from that experience where you can leverage that knowledge that you've gotten, into future endeavors. So that's kind of my
Absolutely.
2 cents. So let's dip into small molecule, large molecule. I think I want to blend that with this idea of pharma, biotech versus med device, right? There are people that specialize in one. There are people, their CV has multiple. I think this is going to tie into the specialization versus generalist concept. But why don't you give me your 2 cents on that?
I think you're right on the money on that one, Nick, with regard to it really does tie into specialist versus generalist. I think back to the way even the regulatory affairs certifications exams were once administered versus how they're currently administered, sort of in the idea of there was a regional approach previously with a very generalist approach to all areas of regulatory affairs in the healthcare space, touching on med devices and pharma. Whereas now it's sort of, I think there's some recognition that folks are more, typically going to work in one area or another, not necessarily cross. And so that's an interesting observation that I've just had over the last few years. But again, I think for me, it always comes back to what you feel called toward, whether that's from a scientific point of view, whether from a problem-solving point of view, and it may even be just some passion that comes from somewhere else in your life, right? It may be an interest in a particular therapeutic area because a family member that's impacted or affected. And so, I don't think there's an advantage per se of being in any of those areas. I think it really is driven by where do you want to go? And it goes back to, as you were saying, the generalist versus specialist, as you sort of discern around where you'd like to be from that point of view, it may give you some hints as to where you might want to be: small, large, pharma, medical device. Because again, they're different. Principally, they're the same, right? You're still trying to, as a regulatory professional, trying to create a story to tell in order to work towards a regulatory approval.
Great. I want to pivot now into, and I saw this early in my working career. My first job out of college, I was interviewing, and the interviewing manager said, look, if you want to become a manager within 12 months, that's possible here. And humble brag, I ended up becoming a manager of the office in 11 months. So it just seemed like a challenge. It seemed like career growth. It seemed like the ladder. I didn't see a reason not to, but there were people in the office and they said, I don't want the stress that's associated with manager, right? And there was stress. So there, again, give and take, there's a balance. So there's the worker, there's the manager, and then, what are we talking about and how high do you want to go? Is there a limit? Is it something where I'm comfortable in a manager role, director role? Do I want a VP role, a C-level role? And then, and maybe toward the end of this discussion, we could even get into, do I want to be a full-time employee or do I want to be an independent consultant and contractor? And this is a big one that I hear a lot from people, I would say in the second or third, maybe even fourth quarter of their working career is, should I go into that space? Or should I, am I ambitious enough to even start my own company? So let's start small and then we'll go bigger, okay. Worker versus manager, director. What do you think about that?
I think that's a soul searching exercise that individuals should take pretty seriously, because there are really good opportunities, for individuals who want to, I kind of hate the term worker bee, but I understand what, it's a term to describe a certain job, because I think some of those.
How about contributor? I want to be a contributor.
Contributor. I like
team,
that better.
Team member.
Team member contributor. Yeah, an individual contributor and team member. I think that there is, you know, a strong necessity. There have to be those individuals that that is their focus. I mean, you need that, whether you're in a big organization or a small one. You need individuals that are going to do that. But you also need individuals who want to manage people and the team and that type of thing. But like I said, where I started, I think that really is an individual discernment process. I really do, and I encourage folks to really think about it and not sort of feel pressured, if you will, because again, like Nick, you just said, you were told you could. And so I'm going to strive to do, and I think you were probably well suited to do that. But at the same time,
I
but it was
up...
early, right? It was very early in your career to, did someone say stop and think about it for a moment? And, you know, is this really what you want to do?
Yeah, well, I will tell you that I was removed from that position within 3 to 6 months. So as much as I was able to get in, I was quickly exited, which was a good decision if we were going to be honest. Yeah. There was a book and then or a concept. It's Rock Star versus Superstar. I think the book and the concept was in Radical Candor by Kim Scott, but I could be wrong. And this actually was more designed toward hiring managers, which is their definition of rock star is somebody that it wants to be an individual contributor, right? They Yes. really like their space. You know that that's where they want to stay. And so if you're looking for that longevity, you have to try as a hiring manager to identify, is that person a rock star? The superstar is the person that is on the other end of the spectrum, which is really trying to climb that corporate ladder. Now, if you're looking for longevity within a particular role, the superstar isn't going to be the right person. However, if we're in a growth company and you can see the benefits of bringing in a superstar that can start at a particular level but grow within that silo area, what have you know, the that practice, then that would be an individual you want to bring, and there's certainly benefits to both. So any other thoughts around individual contributor and manager and kind of the benefits and risks?
You know, I think there is a risk if you know, if you go into that managerial role and you're not ready for it, because
Amen.
it's a shift. Yeah. It's a shift, right? It's a shift in the way you think. And it's also a shift in how you spend your time. And I think that's something that folks may underestimate when they move from that individual contributor to a manager type of role, because it becomes important to, you know, because a lot of times we gauge our productivity by the things that we produce, right? By definition. What you're trying to produce as a people manager is people. And so, you know, it's not necessarily something you can walk into your performance review as a manager and say, I have, you know, produced a good worker. You know, or a good contributor, or a productive contributor. Maybe that's the way to say that. But, you know, it takes time to do that. And you can't underestimate what that's going to take, because again, those folks are counting on you to be that for them and be, you know, in that role for them. So that's why I kind of started the whole topic with, I think it really takes a lot of discernment on the individual level, to know yourself and know where you want to be. I had someone in my a peer, but I was a team lead for a group of folks. And I remember that someone, one of the individuals, came to me and said at one point, "Why do you think everyone should have to advance or go back to school?" Or, you know, and in fairness, I wasn't really saying that, but it probably was coming across that way in some way to some individuals, that I was trying to push people towards advancement, if you will, quote unquote. It was a good thing it happened early in my career before I was truly a people manager, because I've carried, here we are, probably 20 years later, and it's still something that's at the forefront of my mind when I think about the individuals that are in my care, so to speak, is that I really have to listen to them. And so, again, that's why I start with a discernment piece, because you have to spend time on that part. And that's different than being an individual contributor where you can say, I produced this report, or we had a successful FDA meeting, et cetera, et cetera. It's your job now to sort of move towards guiding other people to be successful in all of those things that you used to be successful in. And so that's a different, it's a mind shift, and you have to be prepared for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was just thinking about, some of the mistakes that have happened in the past. I'm a really good baseball player, and therefore I must be a good manager. They're two completely different skill sets. So if you're going to transition from being an individual contributor to a manager, understand there's a whole nother skill set that you're going to have to learn. The interesting thing about being a leader, and there's so much good content out there about how to be a good leader, how to be a good manager. Yeah, I'm still amazed when I hear stories from colleagues, friends, family about bosses that are still living in the 50s through the 80s. It's fascinating to hear some of these toxic work environments that do still exist. And I think one of the things that is good for people to understand if they're looking into getting into management and leadership is, as an individual contributor, you have one boss. As a leader and manager, you have many bosses. So it's not that they work for you. In reality, you work for them. I guess you could say it's very similar and synonymous to the government, right? We don't work for the government. The government works for us. So it's a paradox, because that person is, above you, on the hierarchy or the org chart, what have you. But in reality, if you're being a good manager, you're actually working for them.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's also just another, there's an application I learned of recently that I thought was really good that I just started listening to. It's called Headway.
Yes, you and I talked about this.
Oh, okay.
The last time we were on the phone together. Yes.
All right. Yeah.
Yes.
So why don't we'll talk about that briefly for the audience. So it's an app you can download on your phone. Essentially, they take any kinds of books that you want, and they put them into these 15-minute clips. So like the Cliff Notes. But if you were really interested in reading Ray Dalio's Principles, but then you saw the number of pages, you may say, I don't know if I'm ready for that. Or you see, Money Master the Game by Tony Robbins. Oh, it's a little thick. So Headway is a, so I'll actually, I'll explain my morning routine. So while I'm getting ready, the first thing I do is I listen to a chapter in the Bible. So that takes about, 5 minutes, because the chapters are pretty short. So that's where I start. And then after that is done, I'll go in the Headway, and they give you recommendations based off of your preferences. So I'll take a look, and it's usually about seven to 10, I
10
think.
10 minutes, yeah.
Seven well, not, 10. Not minutes, the options home
right.
screen. So you can, so they'll give you maybe 7 to 10 options, and I'll go and I'll look and I'll say, this one makes sense for me today, or that one makes sense for me today. So it's just a one little thing that I do daily. I know you're a fan as well. That will just kind of, again, when it comes to learning, and I'm actually writing a book. I think we may have talked about this, called The Passionate Workforce, should be out, next year, hopefully before October. So stay tuned for that. But there's, a lot of things you can do in terms of just trying to get those little, I'm sorry. I remember the point I was trying to make. So there's there's different kinds of books. There's transformational books, and then there's books that are easy reading where you get nuggets, right? So a transformational book would be Traction, which is the kind of the big book for the EOS operating system. That is a very dense book. That is something you need to sit down and read and take notes. You cannot do that book on a treadmill, right? Money Master the Game. You cannot do that on a treadmill. But then there's other books like Radical Candor, Extreme Ownership, Blue Ocean, where you can read those types of books or listen to those books on the treadmill. So, Headway is just another application, but there are those different types of books. So now I want to kind of think about and maybe get to the last point, which is for people in their second, third, fourth quadrant, certainly not first, people that are looking into becoming an independent consultant, right? Yeah. There are people that are in their 30s kind of looking at it early and saying, hey, is this something I can get into? There are people later in their career, maybe 50s, and they actually want to put a good amount of time into it. There's people in their 60s that maybe it's just kind of like, I call it pre-retirement, mm-hmm. right? I don't want to work 40 hours a week, and I also don't want to sit on the couch. So, what are your thoughts as people ask themselves, is consulting or entrepreneurship something for me?
Yeah, I think, I probably sound a little bit like a broken record, but it's a little soul searching for yourself. Do you want to be part of something? Because that's the side of full-time employment that you lose when you go the independent consulting route. As a full-time employee, you're in it to win it, right? Like you are part of the team, you are part of the company that is striving for a particular goal. And so there are folks that really want to feel part of something. As you move towards independent consulting, that can still be the case in certain situations, but it's also not the case in many situations. You are viewed as, someone that can help, but you may not be part of the deeper dark team, right? The invested team. And so that's important. I think the other thing, full circle, we'll go back to the beginning, which has to do with specialization and general knowledge and certain things. I'm not saying that you have to be one or the other to be a good independent consultant, but you need to understand who you are and what your knowledge base and assets are that you bring to the table as an independent consultant so that you understand what your opportunities might be. Mm-hmm. So if you are a specialist, right, you're going to need to look for clients that need that specialty. If you are more of a generalist, you may have more flexibility in who you can help. As we talked about before, there's a flip side to that coin that says you may not be their first choice because you have such a broad experience and they may not see you as having enough experience in the specific thing that they're looking for. Mm. There's a risk to being an independent consultant. You have to be prepared for that. There's an ebb and a flow to business. I know a number of consultants right now that feel, the pressure over the last, let's say, at the beginning of quote unquote COVID, everything was kind of going up in the right direction. And now we're sort of in a slump. So economically and everything else, that as an independent consultant, you've got to keep your eye on that too, so that you can plan accordingly for your own financial stability. But that's something that is something you have to recognize. Mm-hmm. as you move into that area.
Yeah. And because this is my world, I could probably do a whole podcast.
You could.
Which I might, now that I'm thinking about it, just talking about for those people that are in industry and they're considering getting into consulting, I have these conversations frequently over the course of a year. And I feel like I have a deep knowledge in the benefits and the takeaways and how to make it successful, right? So I think I'm gonna save that for another episode. Little teaser for the audience.
There you go. I will be listening.
Hey, super. Before we wrap up, I got a few questions for you. I'm going to kind of throw them all out at you and you can answer it how you see fit. What are some special lessons you've learned as it pertains to the topic for today that maybe you haven't mentioned yet that you want to mention? Are there any books that you think could help for the people that are asking a lot of these types of questions? And is there any advice that you would give to people as they're going down this journey?
So again, it's a theme for me, and those that work with me have worked for me and work with me know that I'm a big believer in spending some time with yourself and discerning where you want to go. Like that's an like you have to invest some time in that, which kind of leads back to the books. One of the most a recent book that I read, which I really loved, is called Love and Work. By Marcus Buckingham. He is out of the original Strength Finder group that put together that. And it's a wonderfully written book to really think about who you are, where you want to go, and what you want to do with your life. Because as he says, it's not important that you love what you do every single second of the day, but it's really important that you love what you do. Generally speaking, it's not going to be easy and you know rainbows and unicorns and such, every single minute. But you have to be working in a work because we spend so much time working, and so that's my book recommendation because it's something that I've read and I keep going back to. You talked a little bit about your morning routine. I have, a way I approach books, right? I do like to listen to them. I like to have a hard copy.
I do the same.
I go back to the hard copy after I've listened to it and kind of with my notebook, then kind of go through and skim and pull out the really good pieces that I want to pull out and kind of put in what I keep as a set of notes on my own professional growth and personal growth beyond just professional, but just personal growth as a parent, as a member of a community, et cetera. I really do advocate for people to spend time thinking to this. I'm making time to do that. What was your last part of that question, Nick?
Advice.
I say stay flexible. Part of when I started thinking about our podcast today, I was thinking about, like we set out, we're always told to set particular goals for ourselves. And I think about like what I wanted to be when I was a child. That didn't happen. That wasn't exactly where I ended up. I have a teenager that's embarking on those decisions right now. And I talk to him quite a bit about, it's not the destination that you're looking for. It's the journey that you're going to be on. And so taking small steps towards that. And I think it's the same for regulatory professionals that may be listening to this. It's like you're in that first quadrant of your career. You're really trying to figure out where do I want to go from here. It's important to spend time with yourself to figure that out. And realize that I might have a goal for myself right now. The fact of the matter is you may obtain that goal quicker than you thought. It may happen faster. And then you find yourself in a situation where you're like, what happens next? And so again, being flexible, adaptable, setting goals for yourself, because I think that's a really important part of growth professionally. But at the same time, looking around and seeing what opportunities exist for you, because there may be something that leads you into a different direction. I've certainly found that that's the case for myself over my career. And I've been really happy that I've been able to make those jumps to this and that and the other and have a broad set of experiences So that's what I would do. That's the advice I would give.
Yeah. I'll compliment what you said and say that we have to really be cognizant of our happiness and our mental health. To your point, you know, we're spending more time with our colleagues than oftentimes we are with our family, right? And because it's such a big portion of your life, if you're constantly waking up with a case of the Mondays or it's really bringing you down, you're losing years. Not only are you losing years, but you're also losing your ability to live your best life within those years. So I would really, really encourage people to say, if you're miserable every day going to work, then you need to make a change. Make a change.
Make a change.
Also, you talk about goals. It's very unpopular opinion. I do set goals. I'm not saying that. But what I do is I focus more on process and setting up systems, processes, and habits that are going to allow me to put me in a good position to get a position to get those goals. So Danny Ainge, who is a basketball player for the Celtics, he was a point guard and later became part of the, or he was a general manager for the Celtics. I think he still might be there. I can't recall. I don't follow his career. But he said to his team, you can't control the scoreboard. The only thing you can control is your position to be able to influence the scoreboard, right? And so there's a whole bunch of different ways you can. I'm in my Headway application this morning, they had kind of a morbid way of talking about this where they said, well, you're not going to eat an elephant all at once. You got to take small bites. So, okay, well, that was their example, kind of, you know, a little strange, but you get the idea. You know, the path of a million miles starts with one step. Yep. So in my thought as it pertains to growth, set up different systems and hold yourself accountable. You know, what time are you waking up? How are you managing your stress with your mental health? How are you ensuring that you're engaging in continuous education? What are you doing even outside of just work? Because if you're not taking care of your body, that's going to affect your work. If you're not taking care of your mental health, that's going to affect your work. Broken relationships are going to affect your work, you know, lack of purpose. So there's lots of things that balloon out from just what can I learn in my particular practice. Yes. That these outside factors have an effect. So definitely being aware and cognizant of that.
Yes, so, absolutely.
Well, Jessica, this was fantastic. I really appreciate your time and knowledge in this. And to everybody listening, if you find conversations like this valuable, please share it with a colleague or your professional network. If you haven't already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at theftagroup.com/podcast and follow the FDA Group on LinkedIn. If you'd like to contact me about project and resource needs, you can either head over to theftagroup.com or get in touch with me via LinkedIn. So thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see y'all next time.